Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 461st episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And today, we are going to, this is something that is not directly related to COVID, but certainly somewhat related. We're going to talk today about virtual visits, and particularly we're going to ask the question, or Tina is going to ask the question, what is the diagnostic accuracy of virtual visits in primary care? Tina, we welcome you to the podcast. Yep. Some people, it's unlikely, but some people might not know you. So can you introduce yourself?
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. My name is Tina Koronik. I'm a family physician who works in Edmonton. And I am also an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and the director of PEER, one of the groups that looks at evidence and tries to simplify it into practical pieces.
And so you guys are, I was going to say, you guys are both immersed in this whole concept. I know just before we started the podcast, we were just talking about how many of your visits are virtual and so on. But it's still, for most people, it's still a fair amount of virtual visits compared to sort of face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead, Tina.
For sure, we still, probably 75% of the visits remain virtual at this point.
That's very similar to what we do, Tina, yeah. I would say.
And although, you know, there are, you know, I think you were also mentioning, Tina, that some people are now going back to a lot more face-to-face and so on.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it depends on the clinic, the group of docs who are working there. Some of my colleagues were mentioning they're back to the majority of in-person visits, yeah, and very few virtual versus the clinic I'm at, where we still are doing a lot of virtual visits. So it's really, yeah, it depends on a number of factors what different docs are doing right now.
And I think, and also, you know, I was going to say, you know, and I think some of the, you know, COVID has obviously been just nightmarish, but I think there are some advantages to doing, you know, sort of the virtual visits and so on. And I think, you know, I'm hoping we don't go completely right back to what we were doing before, because that would be a big shame, because I think we could learn a lot from it. But one of the questions is, you know, are virtual visits as good as in-person visits? I know you looked at this in a fair amount of depth, right, Tina?
Yeah, so this was, it certainly was, when we were sort of forced into this rapid change to virtual visits, I think a lot of us were a bit uncertain initially, because it was so different from what we've been doing. And one of the questions that sort of came up a few times is, you know, are we actually causing harm? Like, what am I missing? How many people am I misdiagnosing over the phone? You know, what good or potential harm am I doing? So that was the question that we were really curious about from a practical point of view. What is it? Diagnostic accuracy. How good am I at diagnosing things over the phone or through a video kind of conference, right, situation?
Because I hate to tell you guys, you're not at 100% even face-to-face.
No, that's a real shocker. I mean, James, that's why it's called a practice.
Exactly right, yeah. So you never get it right.
I was going to say one more thing about, Tina was talking about reasons. One of the other reasons that could be a potential driver is compensation, right? So if you're compensated more for seeing patients in person, you'll be driven more quickly to return to in-person, mm-hmm, visits, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a really good point, Mike, because at my clinic, we are salary-based. So the compensation piece doesn't matter as much for us. And so maybe that's part of the reason we're still doing a lot of virtual, because like James said, there, even though we were initially forced into it and a lot of us sort of felt a bit uneasy doing them initially, a lot of us have come to really appreciate them, because they are, yeah, in many cases, they simplify things, they make it easier for the patient who doesn't have to travel across town and wait and take time off of work. And sometimes they simplify things for us too, because we can have quick follow-ups and maybe squeeze a few more things in the day, from that point of view.
Great. So what did you find for the evidence, Tina, to address this question?
Yeah, so I will start by saying there is a ton of evidence out there on virtual care, telemedicine, all of these sorts of things. But the problem is very little of it relates to the question that we asked, which was really how what is the diagnostic accuracy when you're using these type of visits compared to an in-person visit, particularly when you have a patient with an undifferentiated illness. So a patient comes in, which is what primary care I like to think is pretty good at, dealing with those undifferentiated presentations. So when we weeded through the evidence, and there were literally systematic reviews of systematic reviews of telemedicine, of virtual care, but a lot of them don't answer this question. They look at questions like access or appropriateness or satisfaction or cost. But in our mind, the real question was, yeah, but can we do it well? So when we narrowed it down to primary care docs looking at this, we really only came up with a few pretty low quality studies that answered this question. But I'll kind of run through quickly what we did find. The first was just a cohort of 97 adults. This was a general medicine clinic in Japan. So what these patients did is they would come in, they'd have an in-person visit followed by a video conference visit with a different physician. And what they did is looked at the diagnostic accuracy of those two visits at 3 months. So they went and reviewed those charts at 3 months to see. And how do they determine diagnostic accuracy? That's a whole other question, right? How do you know if that was the correct diagnosis? Well, has the patient come back with new problems? Have they had to be seen again? Is there other evidence in the chart that correlates with what was diagnosed? And what they found at 3 months is there was not really any significant difference in diagnostic accuracy between the in-person visits or the video conference visits. So in-person was about 83%. Video conference was about 80%. And the most common presentations in this situation were respiratory, about 22%, digestive presentations, and then circulatory presentations. So the other thing about this is in this particular study, like I said, none of these were great quality studies. Just over 40% of them were chronic presentations. So is a chronic presentation really an undifferentiated illness? Unlikely. But they didn't really parse that out very well, but about 57% were acute presentations that seemed to be undifferentiated. So it gives us some idea that there was similar accuracy between the two types. So the second study that we found was an audit of almost 600 virtual visits. So this one was interesting in that they had standardized patients. So they had 67 different standardized patients, and each patient would present with one of six predetermined presentations. So either they had ankle pain or a pharyngitis or a UTI, and they looked at how well physicians were able to diagnose these in a virtual visit. And the variation in diagnostic accuracy in this case depended a lot on the presentation, so depending what you were calling in for. If you were calling in with symptoms of a urinary tract infection, they got that bang on about 91% of the time. If it was a rhinosinusitis, that was about 71% of the time. This was interesting. This audit was also looking at commercial virtual visits. So what I mean by that is there's some companies that will offer virtual visits. And so they looked at different companies and found a difference amongst different companies as well. And one of the limitations here is it wasn't representative of really a primary care setting, right? Where you have continuity of care, where you know your patients. It was just a single concern, which many of us know in primary care is not often the case. Often there's multiple cases, concerns, there's no long-term follow-up or any sort of really more complex presentations.
And now, as you Tina, mentioned,
oh, go ahead, James.
And as you mentioned, they're not, these were standardized patients. They're not even real patients. So, I mean, it is probably one of the better ways to do it if you want to see if there's any difference, but you know, that's quite different.
Right. Because a standardized patient will probably almost be like a textbook type of patient.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the patient we really don't see that often in our practice.
But so. Would love to see. But would love to see. And the 9% of UTIs that were missed, I'm just wondering what that story was, how bad that was to miss 9% of UTIs. Like, you know, it burns when I pee. I have to go pee more often. I'm not, you know, crampy pain or discomfort. You know,
and then you go hypercholesterolemia.
I might throw a rotator cuff tear. I mean, we're making fun. It probably is a lot harder than that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know, right? That's got to be like whenever they talk about recommended visits for virtual visits, UTIs come up all the time.
Because they're core to what we see. And they are one of those things that actually we should be diagnosing virtually entirely on history. You really don't need a urine dip much at all. And you don't, unless there's something suspicious going on, you don't need urine culture.
Yeah. And the evidence is really clear for that. I mean, this is something that's being studied in, you know, extensively.
I know it has been, and so it's just funny that 9% were missed. I'm just wondering what happened there.
And whenever I hear standardized patients, I always think, I don't know if you guys remember the Seinfeld episode when Kramer, they're all going in, and Kramer and one of his buddies were going in, and they were being given the conditions that they were going to treat. And I remember just Kramer coming out, he was terribly excited because he'd gotten gonorrhea. And he comes out shouting, "I've got gonorrhea."
We may have digressed.
Yes.
Back to the best study, which was an RCT.
Okay. So this, yeah. So the next study is actually my favorite. A randomized crossover trial, 175 patients in primary care. So what they were randomized is to, some of them came in and they would have a video conference. And then they would be, have to repeat their story to an in-person physician, and other patients were given, just had to see two different physicians in person. So then they compared the agreement. So this wasn't so much accuracy, but what was the diagnostic agreement between these groups? So if you look at the diagnosis in a video conference compared to that in person, the agreement was about 84%. My favorite part of the study is that the agreement between the two different physicians was 80%. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not statistically significant at all, and these are small numbers, but the agreement between two physicians was worse than the agreement between a video conference and an in-person visit, which speaks to that, I think, first jab that you hit us with, Jane, that even if we see people face-to-face, we're not always right. Which is
on the same day. Like literally, you know, right. One after the other,
yeah.
The same person, we can't agree. And it's one in five there. So, yeah. And I'm not saying I would do any better. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. I'm looking at that and going, ooh, that seems pretty good. But it's an important thing to reflect on that. Yeah. And that's why when you hear the confidence that some of us exude, mm-hmm. It's most likely false. You know, the old expression, often wrong, but never in doubt.
But yeah, right. Which speaks, like, I love the sort of the audacity of even asking this question, how good are virtual visits, when we could really ask ourselves, how good are we at baseline?
Yeah.
Why continuity of care, I think, is a huge piece of this, right? You might get it on the second visit. Or
or for me, try 16 years and then I'm leaving.
Because I was gonna ask you guys, so what do you, you guys have now had experience in, you know, obviously both areas. What's the main thing that you think you might be missing if it was... let's go through sort of like you got teleconference, you got video conference, and you got in person. What are the main things that you think you might be missing? I can appreciate with a, you know, you got a teleconference, you're not seeing the person. That's a big miss.
Well, they can do all sorts of things, right? So they can send you, so for certain things, they can send you information. So for example, they can send pictures. Mm-hmm. And things like that. So you can get over some of those barriers. And then sometimes the story is just very difficult to sort out the way it's described. And I've seen one where I thought to myself, the story was so bad that if I had seen that person in person, it would have been much easier. But I don't know for Tina, but I would say undifferentiated new presentations almost always lead to an ask to come in for, and I'm not talking UTI, no, but like a real kind of complex, you know, unclear belly pain, feeling tired, blah, blah, blah. That, that's almost certainly going to be an in-person visit. That's going to need a physical exam, you know, checks for weight, all that kind of stuff that you can do in one fell swoop. So I don't know the, you know, the difference or specifically, James, when you're asking which ones I'm going to miss, but I do know that after a fair number of undifferentiated patients, or when I see patients who are undifferentiated on the, or talk to them on the phone, I often end up calling them in for an assessment. The easy in-person visits are, you know, things like refills, BP right. checks,
oh, for sure.
have their BP monitor, like things like that. But when you don't, I find the undifferentiated, I often bring in, especially if they're complex.
Yeah, no, yeah, no, that makes sense. What about you, Tina? Is that the sort of same experience?
Yeah, I would say it depends on the acuity of it, right? Because it is almost like initially you can, there are certain things you can say, oh, yeah, that's a UTI, or yeah, you've got pharyngitis, or what have you. But yeah, it's the ones that aren't very clear initially. So I would agree abdominal pain is something, you know, that we certainly need to see over the phone. Yeah, there's so many things. Actually, one of my colleagues just the other day was telling me she diagnosed quite impressive angina over the phone, and that patient was seen same day in emergency, and that was a phone visit. So good for her. So yeah, you know what? It allowed for the patient to be seen quickly. But certainly, I think it's the ones that aren't clear initially, which doesn't maybe that doesn't give you much to go on. But when you talk to them and you're still no further ahead, that's the ones I need to bring in. Because those are the ones I'm a bit worried about for sure. Yeah.
So that's sort of the diagnostic accuracy. But I know, Tina, you guys had a quick look at some of the stuff on, not a look at, but you said there's a lot of stuff on other things other than that. But did you guys have a general feel of the, what the systematic review showed for access and satisfaction and so on?
Yeah. So if you look at the systematic reviews on this, they generally, and actually, to be honest, some of it's a bit frustrating because there is a bit of conflicting data on there, but they'll say overall it seems to improve access. Generally, patients are quite satisfied with it, as are many physicians. There's conflicting data on cost and clinical load because some of the studies and some of the reviews suggest that virtual visits will result in an increase in visits down the road, and partly due to this mm-hmm. fact that I'm seeing more people over the phone, but then there's going to be more people I'm not sure about, and they're going to need repeat visits. Mm-hmm. So instead of just seeing them once in person, you're having a couple of repeat virtual visits. So it seems to almost increase clinical load over the long term. So it is sort of interesting. Actually, one thing that I think one of my favorite finds on this was there was a paper out of Australia where they talked about their long-term plan was to increase virtual visits. But one of the other goals was to determine, you know, are they effective and do they work? So I, which I thought speaks perfectly to what we know about them right now. There's some conflicting data and long-term, you know, how it seems like everyone likes them, but yeah, with regard, especially workload, I find interesting. Like our nurses have commented that the workload with virtual visits for them has increased substantially because of the online prescriptions and notes and labs and all these things that need to be distributed. That's something else to consider for sure.
And I noticed one thing that was a little bit trickier was, you know, trying to, because I just from a personal experience just over the last few months with some family members of trying to, you know, sometimes it's of value to have the family member go in with the patient and so on. And it was not necessarily the easiest thing to set that up, you know, to have, you know, one person on one phone, one on another. It wasn't seamless by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you need that sort of ability to get more than just the one person on the phone and so on. And do you guys have any experience with that? Or has that been an issue where you've got family members on the phone or at least participating?
Sometimes a patient will give consent for another person to actually do the phone call.
Right.
And then sometimes what happens is they will ask if it's okay if they go to speakerphone, or I'll confirm that they're okay. And then they put the speakerphone, they put it on speaker.
Yeah.
And then someone's present. So those are the two things that I've had encounters with.
Yeah. This is where I couldn't be physically with the family member. And so you got two phone calls, but linking everybody in. And it worked actually really, really well.
Yeah. In a way, it's allowed us a little. In some ways, I appreciate it because we've had other, especially say with some of the elderly patients, other family members join, which has been really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have had some difficulty. We have some patients with some language barriers, so that makes the telephone visits extra tricky at times because it sometimes it's just a bit more difficult to understand. So that's something that we've had to try to manage as well.
So if you took all this and put it into context, what's the sort of the context that you would put around this puzzle?
So I would say based on the evidence we have, there are certainly a number of conditions that we can manage virtually that will probably be as good as if we had seen the patient face-to-face. There are certainly some question about diagnostic error, but again, as we've talked about, there's lots of observational studies looking at diagnostic error just in primary care in general. Mm. And the estimates are all over the place, but one kind of summary statistic was about 5%. And a lot of those misdiagnoses weren't the super rare things. You know, we always learn, you're going to miss Addison's. We know it. Yeah. But there were things like pneumonia or heart failure. And certainly I'm sure we can all think of a time when we missed a pneumonia in a patient when we saw them in person. Mm-hmm. So that's all pretty reasonable. The other thing I'll mention just briefly, which I know is somewhat controversial, say here in Alberta, is the introduction of some of these commercial virtual companies that will offer sort of almost like Medi-centered style kind of virtual care. And I know some physicians are a bit frustrated with that because it erases that continuity of care piece. And there's a lot of evidence around continuity of care, particularly in primary care, that results in lower overall healthcare costs, reduced hospitalizations, reduced mortality. So that employing virtual care in the context of an already established primary care relationship is probably the best way to move forward.
Yeah. No, for sure. So anything else on that? We should probably, I know, Tina, you like to think that want the audience to think that you did all this on your own, but you didn't.
Again, I would like that to be the case, but it wasn't at all. And in fact, this, we had a summer student, his name is Logan Sept. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we published it the first time as Logan Gates. And he said, well, that looks like I'm a long lost heir to Bill Gates, which I appreciate. That's not my name. So Logan Sept, who was a summer student, he's a medical student who worked with us. He did a fabulous job. He did a ton of work on this. And like I said, there are literally hundreds of studies, but to weed through them, the ones that focus on primary care, what we're looking at, there's really, it's a lot of work. So he did a great job. And then Jessica Kirkwood, who's a peer team member, also did a lot of great work on this tool as well.
Yeah, we've had her on the podcast at least once or twice, I think. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is good. Yeah. So anything else on this, Mike? Do you want to add any words of wisdom? I mean, I know you always want to.
But I offer lots of words, James, but
yes.
Not
words. No.
Wisdom. Yeah. Yeah. I know what you're looking for is quality, but I'm going to make up for that in quantity.
Nice. Okay. 1, 2, 3, go.
Good. I think this was an important topic given what's happening now. Also, there's a lot of, there's not many guidelines on exactly what could be or should be virtual visits. And I think it's almost going to be impossible to nail down that anyway. And I think what I liked about this the most, or what caught me, was the recognition that a study actually compared to regular visits, because just comparing to virtual visits doesn't answer the question. You have to figure out how good we are compared to each other. And the 80% is probably pretty good. I know most people who aren't physicians would think, man, that's not very good at all. But actually, that's probably pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it looks like virtual visits are very similar to that. So that's very reassuring, I think. And I think you always have the safety net to bring people in and see them in person when you're ever in doubt. And sometimes it requires in-person visits to see how patients are doing, like some wound healing. I had a guy recently who I was bringing in all the time who had terrible, absolutely terrible edema, lots of reasons for it, from drugs and other things. And we were stopping one and bringing him in, changing one, bringing him in and trying other things. So I felt it needed constant in-person reassessment. But the majority of my care, just like Tina's, probably 75% now is over the phone.
And I think it'll get better as we get some tools that are useful. I know a number of months ago we did a podcast on, you know, how do you assess, you know, shortness of breath and over the phone or video conference and so on. And I think we'll get better tools where we're more comfortable doing those sorts of things. I mean, I don't think we're going to do, home CT scans and things like that, at least not yet. But, you know, I think the opportunity is really has some great advantages for mm-hmm. a lot of people, especially some of the sort of the follow-up stuff that, you know, you're literally, it is a hassle to have to come in. And but I think you guys should get properly paid for it. It's not, I think payment will probably drive a lot of this.
Yeah, I do think that's the case. Here in British Columbia, we're paid the exact same now, whether we're seeing patients in person or virtually. So it really doesn't matter. And I think that's why you've seen Tina and I have a very similar split, where people who aren't paid the same probably are seeing a lot more in person.
Excellent. So just quickly, Mike, the PIPE conference is very close.
It is exceptionally close, James. Yes. And it's only a week or two away. Yeah,
2 weeks away.
October 23rd and 24th. And I think there's still still selling tickets for that. So you can join us virtually. I think that's until the 16th, isn't it, Tina? Can you remind me?
That sounds about right. I don't know, but I know they have a cutoff that's a few days before the actual conference. So absolutely.
Yeah, but there's still lots, and it's we've been doing this for a while, the virtual conferences, well before COVID. We've been at it for years and had a lot of good results, knock on wood, that it'll continue. But we've had like 300 people plus at home or in other places calling in with their questions, etc. And it's always gone well, and it's rated very highly by participants, the virtual. So you can be reassured that if you do join the PIPE conference, we have experience with that. So you can Google PIPE. It's P-E-I-P, which is closer to the PEEP show, but we didn't have the same ring to it, even though Tina pushed for that. So it's the Practical Evidence for Informed Practice conference, and yeah, check it out, because we do have experience with the virtual, and I think it's just as good.
And I think virtual conferences are going to be the way of the world going forward for quite a while. Because I think COVID's going to impact that, and you know, healthcare and education and all that sort of stuff. So anything else, guys? If not, I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.